You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Police shootings and the shooting of police have captured the attention of the people in a way that's not happened in decades. Conversations about race and respect for authority are dividing us. A new film explores those issues as a backdrop to its focus on the militarization of the police. The film is Do Not Resist. The director is Craig Atkinson, and he joins us now by Skype. Before we get too far into this, during this year, I wanted to let you know I've done several reports on a presidential commission appointed after the many civil disturbances throughout the country in 1967, including the uprising of black residents in Detroit. That commission, the Kerner Commission, came back with a blistering report about white attitudes towards black citizens, and more broadly, government treatment of those citizens, including how police treated black residents. It specifically warned against the militarization of police in 1968. So the question is this, just how militarized are police departments these days?
Well, I mean, if you look at the post 9/11 funding to police departments for equipment, the figure that we cite in the film is $39 billion. You know, $5 billion of that was through the DOD and about $34 billion was through DHS. The 1033 program, which is, you can trace the roots of it back to the Nixon administration, had been giving DOD equipment to police departments for the last three or four decades. But, you know, after 9/11 and the establishment of the Homeland Security Department, that was really the influx where you saw an additional $34 billion. And like any other business, you get the returns where you put the investment. And in this case, we happen to put it into equipment.
Yeah, let's talk about that 1033 program. You filmed a congressional hearing about the 1033. Members were asking about monitoring, whether anybody was watching to see how these military vehicles and things such as surplus bayonets were being used in light of the fact that they are explicitly banned from being used in the suppression of riots or demonstrations. What was the answer?
Yeah, the answer was that there is absolutely no oversight when this equipment goes out. That's the end of the oversight from the DOD or the DHS or the Justice Department. There really is no oversight whatsoever. You can look to Maryland to, as far as reporting statistics for SWAT, was the only state that actually had SWAT reporting statistics. And they only started that because the mayor of Berwyn Heights, Maryland, had his house raided by mistake. And after that, and after the SWAT team shot his dog and he was very emotionally distraught over this experience, he pushed it through the legislation to get reporting statistics. So in 2010, they started to report when and how SWAT was being used. It came up for a ballot initiative in 2014, and they dropped that off of the initiative. So there no longer is reporting for any SWAT team throughout the country. And I think that that's part of the reason why we don't have good stats on how and when SWAT is being used. While it was being reported, it's very interesting. It basically paralleled the ACLU's finding, which over 90% of the SWAT deployments were for search warrants, and the vast majority of those were for drug search warrant cases. And that's our anecdotal evidence as well.
I want to get to that in a little bit, but I want to get a better idea why police feel they need these. In the film, they said that they're at even greater risk from armor-piercing bullets and other violence. One officer even explained that they need these armored vehicles and better military hardware because of the threat of Islamic State operatives. At a big police chiefs convention, FBI Director James Comey said this.
Monsters are barricaded inside apartments waiting for law enforcement to respond so they can fire rounds that will pierce a ballistic vest. Because of that reality, because monsters are real, we need a range of weapons and equipment to respond and protect our fellow citizens and protect ourselves.
So when you talked to police officers across the nation when you were doing this film, was that the general feeling among them?
Well, I think that most officers trace this back to the North Hollywood shooting. I mean, across the board, officers will cite that as a motivating factor to arm themselves. And that's when two individuals, put on body armor and robbed a bank in Hollywood. And, you know, police departments were so ill-equipped that they had to go to pawn shops in order to get equipment sufficient enough to neutralize that threat. And that was in the early 90s. I mean, I will tell you that the police officers that I spoke to, the vast majority were saying, yes, we're going to be using this to fight Al-Qaeda or ISIS, and that's why we're training. And in the training modules that we filmed, yes, they looked very equipped and well-prepared to handle something like that. And coming from a law enforcement family, I want our police officers to be well-equipped for these types of incidences. Look at the Pulse nightclub shooting, where they took an armored vehicle and punctured a hole in the side of the nightclub and were able to free hostages. The unfortunate reality, though, is that while we keep saying we're preparing for the next terrorist event, which statistically is very, very rare, we're using the exact same equipment to do search warrants for oftentimes low-level offenses. The example that we show in the film is a home that's raided, that's supposed to be a drug kingpin, and it's a 22-year-old college student, and he has a gram and a half of weed, but yet he has to go to jail for that, and his property is seized under asset forfeiture. So there's a large disconnect between the stated reason for this equipment and how it's used on a day-to-day basis.
You mentioned your family being law enforcement. Your father was not only an officer for 29 years, but he commanded a SWAT unit in suburban Detroit starting in 1989. Now, since 89, police departments are getting, as you mentioned earlier, these tens of billions of dollars in military hardware through the 1033 program. They're getting all kinds of surveillance equipment and software that's being used to keep tabs on its own citizens, often without the residents knowing. What does your father think of the film and what it shows?
Well, you know, for someone that dedicated themselves so completely to the profession and approached it with a great deal of integrity, I think it was pretty heartbreaking for him to see how SWAT became a part of routine police work. I mean, in his era, you're only talking about 3,000 SWAT raids a year. And, you know, to give you some context, he was on SWAT for 13 years, and they only did 29 search warrants total. And you contrast that to teams that we were going out with of a similar size, and they're doing 3 to 4 raids a day, over 200 a year. And so I think it was incredibly disheartening for him to see a profession that he dedicated his life to evolve into something that I know that he wouldn't stand behind. You know, I think that he saw the value of SWAT using for the most violent situations in the one-off instances where you needed the heavy armament, but to do it as a routine part of police work, I think that he identifies that as an overreach of the tools that can be useful in other circumstances.
Your film opens in Ferguson, Missouri, when there were demonstrations going on about Michael Brown's death, and after the basically no charges were going to be filed against the officer who shot him. Was military gear used by law enforcement in Ferguson? And if so, why did they say it was necessary when for the most part, it was a peaceful demonstration?
Most well-trained departments never respond to protests in this manner. I mean, the protocol is basically put plainclothes officers amongst the protesters to help facilitate the protest because the people have the right to protest. Then you have the uniform officers. Then you have the riot officers. And then you have the SWAT team usually parked to the side because it's an eyesore for the community. And it also gives the community something to rally against if they see a opposing force. I mean, they're upset by the very nature of wanting to protest. They're obviously upset about something. So if you give them an outlet for that, such as a SWAT team on the front lines, that has a tendency to escalate the situation. However, you know, the opening shot of the film, it's on a SWAT team who's standing on the roadside in Ferguson, Missouri, and you see all of a sudden the protesters walk by. So instead of holding it back just to see if it was going to escalate into violence, they met the protest community with the full armament that they had been given to basically address a Fallujah-level attack or a ISIS-level of attack. So again, you know, here we are giving the equipment. There's no oversight on when and how it's going to be used. And there's a senator that mentions that it actually says that it cannot be used to quell protests or riots. And yet, despite that, that's stated in the DHS protocols, that's how it's being used. And with no oversight or reporting statistics, you can see how something like that can open itself up for abuse.
A number of police officials across the nation have been critical of how things were done in Ferguson, but they also say if police departments don't have this surplus military equipment, these big vehicles that SWAT teams use and so forth, wouldn't more officers' lives be at risk? What's your answer to that question?
Well, I'm, like I said, you know, there's some of the armored vehicles such as the MRAP, which was designed to resist roadside bombs overseas, and they're 45,000 pounds and they're prone to rollovers. And in fact, multiple law enforcement agencies have rolled these vehicles over. Something like that I feel is excessive. However, you know, you have a smaller armored vehicle known as the Bearcat, which is essentially, you know, on an F-250 chassis. Something like that can be very useful for law enforcement in the right circumstances. So again, let's keep it for the circumstances that you are selling to the community that it's going to be used for, and let's not bring it out on low-level search warrants where it just creates such ill will. And I think that we need to rethink how we're deploying such equipment in these communities, because it's just, you know, creating the type of environment where people start to resent the police presence. And obviously that's the exact opposite of what we're looking for from our police departments, and certainly in this day and age.
Your film, Do Not Resist, has received some critical acclaim. I'm wondering, what have some of the officers you met or talked to, have they had any comments about the results of participating in your film or the observations the film makes?
The one thing that I'm most shocked about has been law enforcement's response to the film. And I'll say that, you know, we screened at the John Jay Criminal Justice College in New York. And that's basically the NYPD's feeder school. And we had 300 people in attendance, and many of which were active duty NYPD. And many publicly got up and stated, thanks so much for making this film. It reflects reality. It shows areas of police work that actually need reform. So, you know, to be able to bring it to law enforcement and show law enforcement and to frame it as a teaching tool, so we're not condemning the individual officers in the film, but more so the style of policing, it's just been very encouraging that they're seeing it this way. And I think that we're going to be able to use that interest to parlay this into a multi-city police academy tour in order to bring the film to the very people who need to sit with it and look at it in a very sobering way and ask ourselves, is this the best direction to move forward with policing? Is this really what the community is asking of their police in this day and age? So I'm hoping that we continue the conversation, include law enforcement in this conversation, not just the community, but all shareholders who are going to have a stake in the way that we move forward.
Craig Atkinson is the director of the film Do Not Resist. It's being shown by the Detroit Film Theater at the Detroit Institute of Arts tonight, Saturday and Sunday at 7 p.m. each night. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for being interested. I appreciate it.